Episode 14 of By Our Own Hands. Sean began to run towards Kate and Mary. The branches in Mary's hands quickly caught fire. She was terrified. She threw the branches to the side, and they fell into the open doorway of the woodshed. Kate picked up the copper pot and tried to walk towards the fire. She dropped the pot just as Sean reached her, and the water spilled out. Soon the flames were easily visible in the doorway of the woodshed, and smoke began to billow out. I ran towards Sean. He turned around as I did. "Aoife, go fetch old man Seamus and tell him to bring buckets," he shouted. I ran like the wind and soon found old man Seamus near the stables. "Fire! There is a fire! Sean said to bring buckets," I shouted, terror seizing me. Old man Seamus moved quickly. He disappeared into the shed near the stables. I stood still, unsure what I should do. He emerged from the shed with several buckets. He motioned for me to follow him. He ran towards the well. I ran after him. When I reached him, he had already filled one small bucket. He filled another and told me to take them. I walked as fast as I could around the house and towards the fire. I struggled to carry the buckets, and water splashed out of them. The smoke had intensified, and it stung my eyes. As soon as I neared the fire, Kate ran towards me and grabbed my buckets. I watched as she doused the fire. It did very little good. The flames were already leaping out of the roof of the woodshed. Old man Seamus rushed past me. He carried two large buckets in each of his hands. He placed them down and started throwing water onto the fire. Kate ran past me towards the well, carrying the empty, smaller buckets that I had struggled to bring. Mary followed her, dragging the copper pot. Old man Seamus finished throwing water onto the fire. He removed his coat and began to beat the fire. I turned around and saw Sean moving towards us with the wagon we had used to ferry baskets to the Murray's cottage. The wagon was loaded with a very large rainwater barrel and two smaller feed containers. They were all full of water. I wondered how he had managed to get the barrel onto the wagon. Old man Seamus turned and eyed Sean. He started running towards him with the emptied buckets. He placed them on the ground near the wagon. "Help me pour," he shouted. Sean and old man Seamus carefully tipped the large rainwater barrel. They struggled to pour water into the empty buckets. They finished, and old man Seamus grabbed two of the buckets and returned to the fire. I saw that one of the buckets had a large, flat, even handle. Sean and I both grabbed the handle, and together we carried the bucket to the fire. We started throwing water onto the fire in a frenzy. Sean and I ran for the smaller feed containers. He hurried back and tossed the water onto the fire. We were all coughing from the smoke. I could feel the heat radiating from the fire. I fought the urge to step back as I tossed water onto the fire. We made another trip to the barrel and tossed more water onto the fire. Finally, we began to see results. The fire was rapidly shrinking, but it was still not under control. When we had used all of the water that Sean had hauled, old man Seamus put the empty barrel onto the wagon along with the feed containers and started hurrying back to the well. Sean and I ran after him. We rounded the house and saw that Kate and Mary were struggling to carry the copper pot. Old man Seamus reached them and quickly rolled the barrel off of the wagon. I grabbed the feed containers and Sean started to roll the barrel towards the well. Old man Seamus dragged the copper pot onto the wagon and returned to the fire. Kate and Mary followed him. Sean and I reached the well and started ladling water into the barrel. We worked at a frenzy. My arms ached. Old man Seamus returned before we had finished. He poured water into the feed containers and handed them to Sean, who immediately ran back to the fire. He handed me the empty copper pot. "Fill it with the water from the tap room," he shouted. I wanted to kick myself for not having thought of it. Mrs. O'Donnell kept large amounts of water in jugs stored in a tap room. She did so because the tap was so slow. I started to drag the pot back to the house. Mary reached for the side of the handle and helped me. Kate ran ahead of us towards the kitchen. Mary and I reached the kitchen door. Mrs. O'Donnell held the door open for us. She was as white as a sheet. She and Kate were waiting with jugs of water from the tap room. As they poured water into the copper pot, Mary and I ran to the tap room. I was dismayed to see that the number of jugs on hand were limited. Kate and Mary had failed to fill them all. I glared at Mary. "Why are there so few jugs of water?" I shouted. I know, I'm sorry," she said. She was on the verge of tears. Mrs. O'Donnell opened the taproom door and grabbed two jugs from me. Kate followed and grabbed one. They both ran back to the kitchen. I tried the tap, hoping in vain that the water would come gushing out. It was even slower than usual. I ran back to the kitchen. I looked at Mrs. O'Donnell and shook my head. "We have no more water in the tap room," I said. "This will have to do," she said, grabbing the handle of the copper pot. I rushed towards her and grabbed the other side of the handle. She didn't argue. We took the shorter route through the main hall and hurried out the front door. We rounded the side of the house. I was amazed at how quickly Mrs. O'Donnell moved. Years of housework had made her strong. I struggled to keep up with her. We reached the fire, and Old Man Seamus grabbed the pot. He hefted the water at the fire. Our efforts were not in vain. I could see that the fire still burned, but it was largely under control. We soon extinguished the last of the flames. We surveyed the damage. The firewood stored in the shed was largely burned, except for some kept at the far end of the shed. The roof of the shed was completely gone, and one of the walls was almost totally burnt through. The tools lined up near the wall were burned, and our wooden handles were wrecked. The woodshed would have to be rebuilt, and almost everything in it was lost. "Mr. Dare will be returning soon," Mrs. O'Donnell said. Mary began to cry. Sean reached for her hand and held it. "Don't cry, Mary. We will tell Mr. Dare that it was an accident," he said. Old Man Seamus glared at us before his face softened. He didn't say anything. Mary sniffed loudly. "Thank you," she whispered. I didn't believe that this explanation would be enough. I knew Mrs. O'Donnell didn't either, because the look on her face said as much. Neither of us said anything in response to Sean's kind assurances. We did not have to wait for long to see how Mr. Dare would respond. We were in the kitchen when we heard Mr. Dare return an hour later. We were all seated at the servants' table. Mrs. O'Donnell was clearing away the dishes when we heard him. "What in the name of God has happened?" he roared. I gripped the edge of the table and looked at Sean with wide eyes. He didn't move a muscle. I could see that both Kate and Mary were terrified. They were both on the verge of tears. Old Man Seamus leapt from his chair and moved towards the kitchen door. Before he could reach it, Mr. Dare himself entered the kitchen. His face was red. He was absolutely furious. I had never seen such fury in all my days. Mrs. O'Donnell did not greet him. She stared at him silently. Old Man Seamus walked slowly towards Mr. Dare. I held my breath. "Sir, there was an accident at the woodshed," he began, before Mr. Dare interrupted him. "There sure as hell was. What happened?" he shouted. "Sir, I was," he began, but he was stopped by Kate. She had rushed towards them and had stopped several feet shy of the two. "It was my doing and Mary's. We were doing laundry in our fire spread," she said before she started to cry. "I want you and your worthless sister out of this house by tomorrow morning," Mr. Dare shouted. Mary and Kate started sobbing. Just then, I saw something I had never expected to see. Mother entered the kitchen. Mr. Dare turned, His expression began to soften at the sight of her. "This does not concern you. Return to my study. I will join you shortly," he said in a voice that was much calmer than the one he had just used. Mother looked at the ground. I could see that she was frightened. She began to speak in a low, trembling voice. "It was my idea for them to do the laundry outside. It was so very hot. They were careful with their fire, but a strong wind blew and the fire spread. If only I had not told them to build a fire outside on such a hot, windy day, none of this would have happened. I am so sorry, sir," she said. I was stunned. I looked at Mary, who reached under the table and squeezed my hand. Mr. Adair shook his head. "Women cannot live with them, cannot live without them," he said. He turned his attention to Old Man Seamus. "Isn't that so, old man?" he said. Old Man Seamus gave him a faint smile and nodded. Mr. Adair started to laugh. He turned back to Mother and shook his head again. "Do not give those silly girls any more ideas, especially if those ideas involve building fires near a woodshed," he said. Mother gave him a faint smile. "I promise I will not," she said. He turned and looked at Kate. "Thanks to you and your sister, I will have to return to Letterkenny and buy some supplies to restore our damn woodshed," he said. Kate kept her eyes fixed on the floor. "I am sorry, sir," she said. He shook his head and walked out of the kitchen. Old Man Seamus followed him. I heard Old Man Seamus say something in a low voice. Mr. Adair's response could be heard through the closed kitchen door. "Yes, yes, the silly girls can stay on," he shouted. We all stared at Mother. Kate ran to her and embraced her. Mary did too. Mother was silent. I looked at Sean. He leaned closer to me. "She did that for you," he whispered. I nodded my understanding, even though I did not understand. I hadn't spoken to Mother since the day of our argument when she had slapped me across the face. I stayed in the kitchen after everyone but Mrs. O'Donnell had left. I knew that she would explain Sean's meaning. "Mrs. O'Donnell, Sean said that Mother did what she did for me and not for the McDermott sisters," I said. Mrs. O'Donnell smiled. "I believe he is correct, love. You and your mother have had a falling out of some sort. She is trying to be a good mother. She cannot be a good mother to you because you two have stopped speaking with one another. Instead, she was a good mother to the McDermott girls," she said, without looking at me. I felt terrible. I realized that Mother believed that I had not forgiven her. I had wanted to speak to her on several occasions since that ugly incident, but I had been too frightened to. I didn't want to be rebuffed. I realized then that I was jealous. Jealous of Mr. Adair, and now jealous of the McDermott sisters. "Mr. Adair will be leaving soon with Old Man Seamus. Once they leave, you can take some tea to your mother," she said. Mrs. O'Donnell was incorrect about one detail that puzzled me. Old Man Seamus normally accompanied Mr. Adair on excursions that involved the purchasing of supplies for the house, but this time he did not. Mr. Adair sent him to collect two of the Scots, Archibald Campbell and Dugald Rankin. It was they that accompanied Mr. Adair to Letterkenny. I was even more puzzled to learn that they had all just returned from a hunting trip. Mr. Adair often took hunting trips, but he never brought his employees as companions. Once I knew Mr. Adair was gone, I took a tea tray to Mother's room. She must have heard me outside her door because she opened the door when I reached it. I followed her into her room. It was clean, and she had a new vibrant blue bedspread. The satin fabric was beautiful. After I placed the tray on her desk, she motioned for me to sit down. I sat down on her bed and watched her prepare our tea. She was graceful and so very beautiful. I was silent for several moments. Mother, I am sorry about the terrible things I said to you, I said, looking down at the floor. Mother turned to me and shook her head. She walked towards me and handed me a mug of tea. She returned to the tea tray and began preparing her own. You were angry, and you had a right to be angry. I have not been much of a mother since we arrived, she said, smiling faintly. I was shocked. Mother was speaking to me as if I were an adult. I forgive you for your unkind words, but you must forgive me for being less of a mother than I should be, she said. I wasn't sure how to answer her. She had not been a good mother. That was certainly true. She turned to me. The terrible thing about this is that I cannot promise you that I will improve. I cannot improve. I need to continue on this path. I have not chosen this terrible path. It has been chosen for me, she added. I could see that tears glistened in her eyes. She believed that she didn't have a choice but to continue on in her disgraceful role. I knew that I could not say anything to her that would convince her to leave and find a life for us elsewhere. Mrs. O'Donnell was incorrect. Mother was not attempting to be a good mother. She believed that the choice to be a good mother or a bad mother had been taken from her. Once again, she was stubbornly refusing to exercise her own will and taking comfort in her own weakness. I did not have the heart or strength to argue with her, so I agreed with her in an effort to comfort her. You belong to him. We all do, I said in a soft voice. She stared at me. Sean said as much, I added. This seemed to console her. I knew that she still felt guilty for essentially abandoning me to be his whore, but my words helped her to believe that she didn't have a choice. I knew that she had a choice and that she had made a choice, but at that moment, I didn't want to contradict her and disturb her illusion. I too was comforted by her illusion. Yes, we do belong to him, but our lot could be far worse, Aoife, she said. I knew that much was true. She sat down next to me. We were both silent for several moments until I broke the silence. Did you know that Mr. Adair left with two of the Scots? I asked. She shook her head. Mr. Murray? She asked. No, Mr. Campbell and Mr. Rankin, I said. Are you sure? She asked. I could see that she was genuinely surprised and interested. Seems Mr. Adair has grown rather fond of those men, she added. I nodded. Is Mr. Adair a Scotsman? I asked, remembering a time when one of the servants had said as much. I wondered if he got on so well with the Scots because they were his own. I do not know. He calls himself a Scotsman, but other times he calls himself an Englishman. I have even heard him refer to himself as an Irishman, she said, with a distant look in her eyes. Is he a bad man? I asked. Mother gave me a faint smile but did not answer me. She rose from her seat. She walked back to the tea tray and grabbed a biscuit. Some say that his ancestors were roundheads, she said. What are roundheads? I asked. She returned to the bed and sat again. I will tell you a tale, one of your father's tales, one of his father's tales, she said. I knew then Mother wanted me to forgive her, but she didn't want me to condone her behavior. My father would have never condoned her behavior. His tales were a reminder of all that he was and all that Mother was not. In the years to come, Mother told me his tales many times. She bequeathed this legacy to me, and I survived without forgetting all that was precious. These tales became mine. Would you like that? She asked. Yes, tell me his tale, I said. And she told me my tale. Isabella had remained at the shore with her daughters, Aoife, Isabella, and Maud. The stones that the old woman had arranged had not moved. The waves came rushing in again and washed over the stones. The waters rushed between and around the stones. Then the old woman suddenly returned. She walked to the stones and bent over them. She touched the first stone in a first row. 14 stones from Isabella, a bloody crown, but not a tyrant, she said. She touched the first of the stones in a second row. 15 stones from Maud, a queen for him who will bear him 2 kings, she said. She tapped the same stone again. 15 stones from Maud, a brother for the king who will suffer in kind, she said. The old woman turned to Isabella and spoke. Your mother's land will drown in blood and tears if the demon is not overcome. Fire must overcome the demon, or her land will be forsaken. Do not fail to heed these words, for the time will come. Isabella watched as the waves once again came rushing in and washed over the stones. She watched the waters recede back to the sea. Grace and violence, a miracle and a tragedy, life and death. The old woman disappeared. Her words came to pass more than 4 centuries later, at the time of Hugh Dorian. When Hugh was in his mother's womb, she dreamt of a fire. She saw a young red-haired man who battled flames that threatened to engulf him. She had battled the fire too. She had known that if she lost sight of him, she would perish. She woke from the dream. The old woman sat at her bedside. She spoke to Hugh's mother in a quiet voice. The young red-haired man is fire, and he was forged in fire. Your son will be fire too. They will have to be fire to overcome fire. If your son fails, he will be overcome. If the other fails, his fire will still burn for an eternity, she said. Hugh Dorian was born in Anglesborough. Rory O'More was born in Ballyfeon, Ballyfin in Leash, the land of their ancestors. Their births were 15 years apart. One carried the blood of Diarmaid and Grainne, the other had been named for his uncle. Hugh's birth had brought death to his mother and sorrow to his father. When his father died, Hugh took him to the land of their ancestors to bury him among his own. It was then he met Rory. As he stood over his father's freshly dug grave, Rory had approached him. We share a legacy. We are brothers, he said. Hugh had been silent, unsure of how to answer, but Rory had smiled. He had stood silently alongside Hugh. They had prayed over his father. We are not strangers. We are brothers, Rory said, repeating his sentiments. He told Hugh to return as soon as he could. Hugh did return several times over the next few years. He and Rory became brothers. Then they became father and son because Hugh grew to love Rory's daughter, Kiva. Hugh could offer her little because his home in Anglesborough was humble and far from her native land. Despite this, she agreed to become his wife. At the dawn of the century, Elizabeth, the Queen of the English, had breathed her last. She had bequeathed her throne to her cousin, the young King of the Scots, James. His mother, Mary, had been martyred by Elizabeth. James left his throne to his son, Charles, who was crowned Charles I of England and Scotland. James had inherited a divided land. Elizabeth's church had satisfied some Protestants, but others wanted a more Protestant faith that bore absolutely no resemblance to Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholics suffered intolerance and persecution, which their king was unable and unwilling to end. James had not been able to fight the rising tide of dissatisfaction which threatened his kingdom. James had married a Catholic, and his son Charles did too. Charles' queen was the French princess Maria Henrietta. Many in England feared that their heir would be influenced by his mother's faith. Many believed that a true Protestant monarch couldn't marry a Roman Catholic. Charles' devotion to Protestantism was questioned just as his father's devotion had been. Charles may have been a Protestant and he may have been a Roman Catholic. Regardless, he was a true king. He loved his people and his land. His queen was devoted to him, and her devotion extended to her husband's land. They had 4 princes and 5 princesses. Charles feared Parliament because its many members that were dissatisfied with the Church of England often directed their hatred at their king. Chief among those members that let their displeasure be known was a man named Oliver Cromwell. Ireland had remained largely Roman Catholic and had suffered under English monarchs, Roman Catholic and Protestant alike. When Charles took the throne and a Roman Catholic wife, Ireland was largely ambivalent. When he dismissed Parliament and ruled for more than a decade without calling them once, Ireland was largely ambivalent. Once Charles did call Parliament, Ireland was forced to take notice. At this time, Hugh had just taken Kiva as his wife. They had settled into their new home in Anglesborough. Rory visited them and told them that the Lord Deputy of Ireland had been summoned to England. Hugh and Kiva knew he spoke of Thomas Wentworth, who had been Lord Deputy of Ireland for 8 years. Wentworth had ruled with an iron fist and had put an end to lawlessness. He had also robbed many people of goods, money, and land. He had allowed further plantations in Ireland, despite giving his king an assurance that he would not do so. He had defied his king, but all knew that he was still a great favorite of Charles. The two were as close as brothers. His departure was a relief, but Rory's words made certain that Hugh and Kiva's relief was short-lived. He is returning to be near his king to support his king. Charles is going to call Parliament to battle the Scots, Rory said. Hugh knew that the Scots had rebelled against Charles when he had tried to force on them the rites of the Church of England. He had insisted that the English Book of Common Prayer be part of the Protestant services in Scotland. He had tried to force uniformity in the hopes that he could end the divide in his nation. The Scots, who were Protestant, had vehemently opposed him. Most of them were not satisfied with the Church of England. Those that were Roman Catholic feared that he would try to force his church's rights on them, too. Scotland's Protestants rejected their king, and Scotland's Roman Catholics needed reassurances before they would fight for their king. Charles knew that he had to subdue Scotland, but he was limited in resources and men. He was forced to call Parliament to ask for the funds necessary to make war on Scotland. The members of Parliament were more sympathetic to Scotland than they were loyal to their king. Charles hoped that Wentworth could persuade many to support their king. If Wentworth fails to turn the tide within Parliament, the king will fail to subdue Scotland, Hugh said. If England's Parliament refuses to assist their king, it is a declaration of war, Rory said. They were silent for several moments.